I want to just take a moment to say that this is one of six or seven lay-led services this summer, as Jennifer said. The theme for this summer is spirituality, and you get to fill in the blank. And so we've had services on spirituality and liberation, which is the book that ties in with our theme. We had spirituality and community. Help me, did we have one in between? Spirituality and creativity or creative awareness. Next week is spirituality and skepticism. That's not the exact title. And is it? Oh, okay, great. Who knew I could be so right? And today is spirituality and women's anger. And although a man can feel a woman's anger not just coming out of him, but coming up out of him, coming at him, not just coming at him from a woman, but coming up out of him. So the readings for today come from the Bible and come from a novel. The first reading is from the Bible. The Bible itself reveals very little about the figure of Mary Magdalene, the woman whose experience is at the center of today's service. Our first reading is comprised of two short New Testament passages, which encapsulate the canonized biblical account of Mary of Magdala.
Soon afterwards, Jesus went through the cities and villages, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him as well. As well, some women who had been cured of evil spirits and infirmities. Mary called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Herod, Susanna, and many others, provided for them still out of their resources. And from John 20, verses 11 to 18, but Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. As she wept, she bent over and looked into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been, one lying at the head, other at the foot. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there. But she didn't know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? For whom are you looking?" Supposing him to be a gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned to him and said in Hebrew, "Rabboni." Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers. Go and say to them, 'I have ascended to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God.'" So Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them the things that he had said to her.
Although, let's see, the second, Jose Saramago, who just passed away in June, is the 1998 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for Literature. In The Gospel According to Jesus Christ, this Portuguese author has reimagined the story of Jesus of Nazareth through the eyes of Jesus himself. And in a single sentence in this novel, the author captures the essence of what it means to be female in the ancient world.
Turning their backs to the lake, the men started walking, followed by the women, most of whose names were never learned. Not that it matters, for most of them are called Mary, and the rest of them will answer to that name. A man need only shout, "Woman," or "Mary," and they will look up and come and do his bidding.
Oh. Although Saramago has perpetuated much of the mythology of Mary Magdalene, he has also given her a voice, one that doesn't always submit to Jesus.
All Jesus has to do is stretch out his arms to that body abandoned by its soul and say, "Lazarus, arise," and Lazarus will rise from the dead because it is the will of God. But at the very last moment, Mary Magdalene placed a hand on Jesus' shoulder and said, "No one has committed so much sin in his life that he deserves to die twice." And dropping his arms, Jesus went outside to weep.
Okay, well, I'm nervous, but I'm here. I think some of my friends thought I wasn't going to be here, and I apologize for that. It was a miscommunication. I'm here because the past year of my life has been the angriest and the most joyful of my existence. And so I volunteered to be here this morning to share that experience with you. Many of you know that I'm a full-time seminary student at Methodist Theological School of Ohio. Many of you know that last spring, this congregation endorsed me to become a ministerial candidate, for which I am very grateful. What you may not know about me is that I have a long, antagonistic, and damaged relationship with the church. As a three-year-old, I was initiated into the literal Baptist tradition. Church became my life. My parents didn't go to church, but they sent me on the bus every Sunday, and people from the church came and picked me up for events. I sometimes joke about this truth: the Jesus people saved me from my parents. But the salvation of the Baptist tradition in which I was raised was based on threats and oppression. When I was in my 20s, with three little children at my feet and no energy for all this fear nonsense, I shook my fist at God and I said, "I'll go to your hell, but I won't live in this fear any longer." Well, I half expected to be struck by lightning. Instead, pardon me, I guess I should sort of turn away to do that clearing. I'm learning. Instead, I found myself grieving. I missed the Jesus people. I missed the relationships. I missed the prayer, the awareness of the sacred in every day. These losses, these longings eventually led me here to First UU. Because of my history with fundamentalism, I was reluctant to go to a Christian seminary. I expressed to my friends the fear that they, the fundamentalist, would once again ensnare me with the temptation of Christ, so to speak, and his community. So imagine my surprise as I sat there in orientation last August. I had my walls up, I had my attitude in place, and a professor rose and said, "We have students running the range from literal Baptist to UU." I said, "Oh, that's me. I am literal Baptist to UU." "You will be expected," she said, "to refrain from judgments and to listen to the spectrum of views with an open mind and an open heart, embracing diversity." Wow. Maybe I wasn't in such a bad place after all. A couple of months later, in a New Testament course, we had completed our study of the letters written by the Apostle Paul, and we were moving on to the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Before sending us off with our reading assignments, the professor said, "Try not to get all twisted up inside judging the historicity of the Gospels. Trying to figure out if this stuff really happened is just a distraction. The real meaning is in the metaphor, in the gospel as story. If you read them for fiction, you'll experience a whole new appreciation for their power. I'm like digging this all over the place. Like, okay, I can do this. Today, as I speak to you about Mary Magdalene, the Catholic saint and the Christian icon, I hope that where needed, you will take my professor's advice and not get all twisted up inside. Relax. The real meaning is in the metaphor. It's in receiving and accepting the metaphor rather than history that I have begun myself to recreate a relationship with Christianity. So, who knew Mary Magdalene had a feast day? Not me. And this is, in a way, how she comes to merit a service that's dedicated to her. But the other part of that is that I took a course based exclusively on Mary Magdalene in January. And nearly two millennia have passed, but Mary Magdalene lingers in our cultural memory. Nearly two millennia have passed, but Mary Magdalene, like Jesus, still appears in our paintings, in our films, in our novels, in our art. And I'm curious about this. After all, from a Baptist perspective, Mary Magdalene was just not a big deal. From a Catholic perspective, she can't really compete with the Virgin Mary. So why all this fascination? Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I have a surprise under here, so I have to make room for it, the water. Okay. So why all this fascination or this fixation with Mary Magdalene? Well, before teaching us anything about Mary herself, the professor was keen on contextualizing the culture of the Roman-occupied Palestine of Mary Magdalene's lifetime. The professor wanted us to know, first and foremost, that one out of every four women was named Mary. The New Testament ratio is a little higher, 7 out of 16. These statistics no doubt take into account variations on the name, Miriam, Marianne, Maria. But Saramago captures the essence of a woman's experience in the ancient world when he writes, "Most of the women are called Mary, and if they aren't called Mary, they answer to that name." There's not much by way of self-definition recorded in their experience. Historically speaking, as was true with Jesus of Nazareth, not much can really be known about Mary Magdalene. What is known is really only speculation. She is thought to have been a Jewish woman from the city of Magdala, situated on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. The Arabic name for Magdala means tower of fish, so she is thought to have been raised in a cosmopolitan environment. She seems to have had enough money to follow Jesus and support his ministry. And that just about sums up what we know about Mary Magdalene, based on the crumbs of information in the Orthodox Gospels, the ones that are sanctioned by the Church. And usually when I say that, it's the Church, the capital T, capital C. The truth is, for someone who maintains such strong cultural currency 2,000 years after the fact, Mary of Magdala is mentioned surprisingly few times in the canonized scripture. So who was Mary in terms of the Christian story? She was one of Jesus's few named female followers. She witnessed his ministry. She witnessed his crucifixion. Only one of the male apostles witnessed Jesus' crucifixion. The rest of them were scared to be there. More so, I've been told. She was the first person to learn that Jesus was not dead. Without hesitation, without considering her status or her credibility as a woman, Jesus commissioned Mary to give this good news to the other 12 apostles. And apostle to the apostles is her sanctioned role in the Gospels by the church. Then we have the Gnostic Gospels, which are not sanctioned by the church and were found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945. The Gospels, this is just some of the Gospels, the Gospel of Mary, Thomas, Philip, and they provide a more developed Mary Magdalene. These largely fragmented texts portray Mary as the apostle Jesus loved most. She is the one to whom he gave the secret knowledge of salvation, the one to whom the others turned for leadership. As the early centuries passed, Mary Magdalene's identity became conflated with the seven other Marys in the Gospels. She was also conflated with Mary of Egypt. By some accounts, she was said to have fled to France with Lazarus and his sister Martha. But a most egregious disservice to Mary Magdalene's identity was her designation as a repentant prostitute, an identity bestowed on her by Pope Gregory in a homily on Luke in the year 591. And though this identity has no historical basis, the branding of Mary Magdalene as a prostitute lasted in earnest for 1,400 years. And many people continue to think of Mary as a rehabilitated working girl. Over the centuries, Mary Magdalene's identity has been fluid, mutable, influenced by the dominant powers of a particular era or culture. Artists and writers in the 20th and 21st centuries continue to reinvent Mary Magdalene, redefining her in relationship to orthodoxy and in relationship to a culture who clings to her as if she were some sort of sacred icon. Like these other writers and artists, I too have now brought to bear on Mary Magdalene my imagination. Unlike those who are concerned with Mary's occupation or her marital status, I'm mostly interested in Mary's demons. The 12 were with him, as well as some women who had been cured of evil spirits and infirmities. Mary called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had gone out. And this is why Mary Magdalene remains relevant to us in the 21st century, to us as humanists, as theists, as atheists. Mary's story is universal. So what about her demons? What might they say to us if they could speak? Would they tell us she had existed solely for others? That she had been defined by their wills and their needs? Would they tell us she had been exploited, treated with contempt, without dignity, or valued only for her capacity to serve others? Or would her demons speak to us only through apoplectic fits? Unpredictable, unexplained, quaking rage that convulsed her body and slaughtered her speech. Demon possession can be loosely defined as the control of someone's mind and actions by an evil spirit. In the world of Mary Magdalene, an entire gender was possessed, their minds and actions subjugated to the reality of others. Here's the moment. Then along came Jesus. I'm glad you laughed. Who has also been brought to bear on my imagination. Jesus, countering his culture, did not see Mary, the woman. Jesus didn't shame her for her rage. He saw Mary, the human being. He didn't blame her for her problems. He treated her with dignity. He respected her autonomy. He recognized her personhood. I imagine that Jesus acknowledged her presence in the crowd. Among the multitudes, he heard Mary's voice. And Mary, in response to Jesus' teachings, in response to his esteem, looked into his eyes and saw a reflection that was utterly unfamiliar. She saw herself. She saw a person, not a commodity. And as Mary's sense of self began to emerge, I imagine she experienced that same paradox of emotions, joy in the discovery of autonomy and personhood. But the rage continued, and now that she knew where the rage was coming from, she was madder than ever. But Mary was not alone. She was in community. And because Jesus and his community allowed Mary to recreate herself, to see and experience herself in a new way, Mary's episodes of anger diminished. As she continued to claim her agency, her autonomy, Mary's demons departed. It's no accident that this is the story that I imagine about Mary of Magdala. It is my story. It is our story. During the mid-year meeting, when the congregation voted to endorse me as a ministerial candidate, I mentioned how valuable this community has been in allowing me to recreate myself in relationship, to see and experience myself in new and exciting ways. You, the congregation, have been Jesus to my Mary Magdalene. In the past year, moving in new directions and new circles, I've had several other Mary Jesus encounters. But I want to take a few minutes to talk about one in particular, and this is my experience in clinical pastoral education, heretofore referred to as CPE. Reverend Mark calls CPE the rotor tiller of pastoral training. Yeah. Maybe that's even an understatement. No doubt, because it demands submission to the excavation and examination of all one's baggage by oneself, by one's peers, and by one's supervisor. This digging is done in the context of relationship. When I walked into CPE, wherever I looked, I saw a mirror in the form of another person reflecting me. In other words, the driving purpose of CPE seemed to be the discovery and the cementing of identity, not standalone identity, but who am I in relationship to others' identity? Because ultimately, in relationship to others is how we exist. In relationship to others is how we are defined. Over the weeks and months of CPE, seven of them, long months, I began to dig around in my personal anger. During meetings with my supervisor and during weekly meetings with my peer group, I asked questions out loud. Was this group really a safe place for me to express anger? If I dip below the tip of the iceberg into the substance of my anger, could this group really receive it? Or would I scare them away? My anger scared me. Might they be shut down by my anger the way I was shut down by my anger? Or worse, driven to retaliate? Furthermore, why was I so averse to anger? What was the nature of the situations which triggered my anger? If my demons could speak, what would they say? Coincidentally, during this time, I experienced an episode in a personal relationship that seriously upset me. When trying to reconcile the situation, my anger, instead of abating, intensified. I was no longer simply upset, I was furious, capital F. My body literally quaked with anger. Now, I recognize that the anger I was feeling was seriously disproportionate to the offense I experienced. And for this reason, in particular, I moved toward the anger, trying to uncover its ultimate source. Aha, my peer group, I thought, was a place intended for just such excavation. And given the next opportunity, I brought this anger story to my group. Instead of exploring the situation that was making me angry, my supervisor said, "Is someone here in the group making you angry?" Oh, I understood the supervisor's move. I mean, the maneuver was intended to let me play out my anger in the live in-person relationships on hand. Could I follow this lead? I pondered the question, and indeed, there was someone in the group making me angry, and that someone was the supervisor. From my perspective, the supervisor favored one member of our group over the others. This was quite the conundrum. Do I really speak the truth? Do I risk expressing a self who is willing to challenge authority? Would the supervisor receive my truth, ignore me, belittle me? In a moment, I made the decision to speak, to trust the CPE supervisor with my authentic self. I scooted toward the edge of my seat, and I started to explain the dynamic I saw going on in the group. And I noticed a new feeling in my gut, the feeling of this monument lodged in my belly, and like a land-sized iceberg bulging against my insides. And this monument was distracting, and my words faltered, and I trembled. And I knew I was moving into my anger, and I was terrified. I literally gasped for air. Not subtle little let me catch my breath displays, but big, wow, hyperventilizing gasp. No one tried to calm me or rescue me or offer up the words that I couldn't bring out. And I finally managed to spurt out my accusation. And in that moment of speaking my truth, of expressing my anger, this monument in my belly shattered. Physically, I could feel this boulder breaking up and dissolving and floating away. As I basked in this cleanness, a discussion ensued over the favoritism concern I had raised. One person agreed with me, but this now seemed like an aside. And in closing the meeting, I was no longer concerned about the favoritism. I just wanted to explain what had happened inside of me. "Something monumental has shifted," I said. And I wasn't sure what this meant, but I knew it was big. For the rest of the day, I felt ecstatic. I felt weightless, pure, as if energy that had been stuck was suddenly percolating through my body. At home that evening, I had time to begin to construct meaning of the experience. And up to this point, I had only dabbled in chakras. But I suspected my experience would fit nicely into this paradigm of the body's flow of energy. So I hopped onto Google, one of my favorite rides, and discovered that the belly button region is home to the navel chakra, the body's emotional center, the center of the life force. One source on the internet described this chakra as the source of our first link to the external world, and the representation of our ongoing connection to others. Aha. Another said the navel chakra, when dominating, motivates an individual to develop identity and ego. And wasn't that the driving force of CPE, my driving force? Who am I? What is my identity in relationship to others? This was just a really big wow experience. Going to sleep that night, I snuggled under the covers with the satisfaction of having had an in-body experience, one that signified an ongoing transformation from a person whose sense of self was seriously lacking into a person whose identity was taking shape and finding solid community. Within the safety of an accepting and thoughtful community, I'd had a breakthrough with an issue that I'd struggled with my entire life. I was recreating myself in relationship with my CPE community as witnesses. My demons departed. This is the same gift I imagine Jesus giving to Mary Magdalene. Acceptance of her anger, respect of herself, dignity for her person. Jesus interacted with Mary in a way that brought healing, that allowed her to recreate herself in relationship to others. And the community who participated in this recreation of Mary witnessed the departure of her demons. The children's story, When I Feel Angry, suggests that anger is a sign that something needs changed. Perhaps the author suggests it is you that needs changed. More downtime, a stronger sense of self, respect, more practice saying, Tina taught me this, no. Perhaps that something that needs changed is outside of yourself. Perhaps it is a situation, a system of oppression that dominates and controls your life and the lives of others. The bottom line is this: regardless of the fear anger can elicit, if we are to be whole human beings, we must move toward our anger, toward the anger of others. We must allow the pain of anger to function as the pain of our body functions, to alert us to our needs, whether that need is the visceral drive for a sense of self or the need for a retreat to restore and refresh our energy. If your demons could speak, what would they say? What would they tell us as your community? Be still with one another. Be vulnerable with one another. As we learned last week in our service on spirituality and community, it's okay to have needs. It's okay to ask for help. We exist only in relationship to others. And may this community be your Jesus to your Mary Magdalene.